From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Film producer Richard Zanuck was still in his 20s when he became the head of 20th Century Fox, the Hollywood studio founded by his father, Darrell F. Zanuck. On today's Fresh Air, Richard Zanuck shares stories about growing up on the studio lot and overseeing such films as The Sound of Music, Jaws, The French Connection, Driving Miss Daisy, and the new adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd. And David Bianculli talks with TV producer Marshall Herskovitz about his new internet series and social networking website, Quarter Life. The show was recently picked up by NBC for broadcast in 2008. Herskovitz co-created 30-something and produced My So-Called Life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The great Stephen Sondheim musical, Sweeney Todd, has been adapted into a new movie starring Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter, directed by Tim Burton and produced by my guest Richard Zanuck. And yes, he is from the Zanuck family. His father, Daryl F. Zanuck, co-founded the movie studio 20th Century Fox and produced such classics as Young Mr. Lincoln, Drums Along the Mohawk, The Grapes of Wrath, How Green Was My Valley, My Darling Clementine, The Snake Pit, All About Eve, and The Longest Day. Richard grew up in the studio and became its president at the age of 27. From Fox, he became a senior vice president at Warner Brothers and soon after became an independent producer. He now has the Zanuck Company. Among the movies he supervised or produced are The Sound of Music, Jaws, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, The French Connection, and Driving Miss Daisy. Let's start with a track from the soundtrack of his latest production, Sweeney Todd. Here's Johnny Depp singing the part of an angry Sweeney out for revenge.
They all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Love, let's tell you why. Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. No, we all deserve to die. Even you, Mrs. Lovett, even I. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be a relief. We all deserve to die. And I'll never see Joanna. No, I'll never hug my girl to me.
Finished! All right, you, sir, how about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You, sir, too, sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on. Sweeney's waiting. I want
Johnny Depp from the soundtrack of the new film Sweeney Todd, produced by Richard Zanuck. Richard Zanuck, welcome to Fresh Air. Whose idea was it to do a film adaptation of Sweeney Todd?
Actually, it took a lot of convincing for many years, but Tim Burton finally persuaded Stephen Sondheim to give up his masterpiece of theater, musical theater, and he gave it to him to make a film.
Do you have any direct interactions with Sondheim about the movie?
Oh, yes. He's been a collaborator all the way through, first with the screenplay and then the casting process. He actually had final approval of the director, he approved Tim, and of
Sweeney
Todd.
Well, who else was he going to go with? Tim Burton's been badgering him for years.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then he had final approval of Mrs. Lovett and of Sweeney. So he approved those two actors, Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter. But it was his final approval that we needed. And, of course, he supervised the music during the course of the picture.
So he was there? He was there while it was being made?
No, he was there for 2 weeks. We pre-recorded all the singing a month before we started shooting.
The last time I spoke with Stephen Sondheim, and this was in 2000, he was talking about how really difficult it is now to find singers who can sing for Broadway, and I think particularly who could sing, you know, his songs. And it's interesting that, you know, neither Johnny Depp nor Helena Bonham Carter are really singers. And I think Depp used to sing harmony with his band, but I don't think he ever sang lead. So these strike me as such challenging songs for people who aren't, like, really seasoned, top-notch.
You're absolutely right. And Tim, from the very get-go, said, I want actors to sing. We can get the great singers of Broadway to come in here and do this, but I want real actors, people who can, may not be the great voices for these songs, which are very difficult. Sondheim is probably the most difficult to sing. But Tim wanted the acting ability and the actors. So all of these people were non-professional singers, all the way, the entire cast. There was one lady who played the beggar woman, who's a singer from the London stage, Laura Michelle Kelly. But outside of that, everyone, including the young people, had never sung professionally before. You know, it was an exercise in courage on everybody's part, particularly Johnny, who is perhaps the biggest movie star out there right now. You know, he exposed another side of himself that nobody had seen or heard, and he took a big chance doing something like that, because, you know, if he didn't have the voice, it would have been bad for the picture and certainly bad for him. But he surprised all of us.
So tell us more about the interactions you had with Stephen Sondheim before and during the filming.
Well, I met him early on, well before we started shooting, and I was with Tim and John Logan, the screenwriter, and we talked about early concepts and just things in general. At first, I was worried that we were taking his masterpiece and putting it up on film, and it was a three-hour stage play, and we were obviously going to have to boil it down to 2 hours or below 2 hours, and that meant some cutting and some editing and, you know, making it a film. And he went right along with that. He was very cooperative. He didn't treat it as a special, anything tremendously special that couldn't be touched.
Tell us one of the questions that you brought to Sondheim.
That we brought to Sondheim?
Mm-hmm.
First, we brought the cast. He asked to see Johnny, and Johnny went to see him, just the two of them. We all thought Johnny would sing for him, or he would demand Johnny to sing, and I think he expected Johnny to sing for him, but after the meeting we found out from Johnny and from talking to Stephen, no, they just talked about concept. Johnny said he wasn't prepared to sing in front of Stephen Sondheim, and Sondheim approved him. And actually, he was the only voice that Johnny that we hadn't heard until about 8 weeks before we had to do the pre-recording. It was nervous-making at that time.
I can't
Everybody
imagine.
Else
I mean,
auditioned.
It's a musical, and your lead character, you've never heard him sing. What an act of faith.
I know. It was one of those things, but sets were being built, wardrobe was being made, all kinds of plans. People were, you know, scurrying around, getting ready to make the picture, but nobody had heard Johnny's voice. And we all just reassured ourselves. Tim, who'd made five other pictures with Johnny, hadn't heard his voice, but we'd sit around saying, well, Johnny's a smart guy. He knows what this means for his career and all of the rest. He wouldn't do this. He wouldn't put himself in this position unless he was convinced that he could do it. But that's all we had to go on, that, you know, the fact that he was a smart guy and that he must have a voice or he wouldn't put everybody and himself in this very dangerous position. And I was in my office at Pinewood Studios, and Tim was in the office next to mine, and he came in. I was on the phone. He came in and just laid a cassette player in front of me with his big earpieces, and then walked out. And I didn't know what it was. I hung up and put it on, pushed play, and there was Johnny singing My Friends, which is one of his great ballads in the piece. And I walked into Tim, and we both practically started crying. He just said, oh, my God, he's better than we dreamt he could be.
My guest is movie producer Richard Zanuck. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is film producer Richard Zanuck, and he's been producing movies since the 1950s. His latest is the new film adaptation of Sweeney Todd, which is directed by Tim Burton and stars Johnny Depp. Let me ask you to just do the roll call of some of the many movies that you've produced. Just, like, tick off a few that everybody will know.
Jaws, The Sting, Cocoon, The Verdict, Driving Miss Daisy, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Planet of the Apes, Big Fish. I gave you the last few that I've done with Tim. But as a young studio head, I put into motion The Sound of Music, The French Connection, Patton, the original Planet of the Apes, MASH, blah, blah, blah. I'm running out of hits.
Well, that's a pretty impressive
list. I can mention a lot of pictures that I'm unhappy that I put into production, but that's not. Please don't ask me about those.
Okay, I'm not going to put you on the spot about that right now. Maybe later.
Okay.
So you got started in movies at your father's studio, the studio that he founded, 20th Century Fox. And when you were in your 20s, correct me if I'm wrong, you were overseeing production of The Sound of Music. And since we just talked about Sweeney Todd, what was it like to do that film? Did you like Hollywood musicals at that point?
Let me back up a little bit. My father had left the studio, and I, at the time I was getting out of college at Stanford, I'd been working on every summer, all summer vacation, starting when I was a young boy. So I was very tuned in to the studio and to the business. I was a very recognizable face on the studio lot because I'd been there, grew up there for years and years and years every summer, and knew everybody, knew everything. When he came back to take over the studio, I'd made three pictures at that time, the first one being Compulsion when I was 24 years old, which won the Cannes Film Festival award at that time. But when he came back, he'd been away for 15 years, didn't know anyone. He came back to protect his picture, The Longest Day, which was his masterpiece. And he was afraid that the studio was going to go under because of the Cleopatra debacle. They were about ready to go bankrupt. They'd sold the back lot, which is now Century City. And he needed someone to trust. And after a long board meeting, which I was at like a fly on the wall, in which he'd taken over the company, the two of us came back and he said, I'm going to take a nap in the hotel. I'm exhausted after this meeting. He said, I don't know anybody out in Hollywood anymore. I've been gone for so long. Make me a list of who you think should be in charge of the studio, and then we can talk about it at dinner. Wake me up at 8:00. So I came, woke him up at 8:00, and he started getting dressed. And he said, did you make up your list? And I said, yes. And I handed him a piece of paper, and all it said was me.
Really?
And that was the list. Yeah, it just said me. And he said, oh, my God. He said, no, I agree. You would be great. And you know the business. You made pictures. You know everybody. He said, but we're going to get killed by the board of directors, and everybody will think it's, and it is nepotism and all the rest, but...
Hey, you were in your 20s.
Yeah, I was 27. And so we went to dinner at Danny's Hideaway in New York. I'll never forget it. We both kind of got loaded. By the end of the evening, he said, I'm going to call each board member tomorrow and tell them that you're in charge. And he did that and then left for Paris, and I left for Hollywood. He never came to the studio in the 9 years that I was running it. He would come into New York for the board meetings each month, but he never came to the studio. And one of the first things that I did was close the studio because they had no productions going and everybody had to be let go, and tumbleweeds were starting to roll down the you know, from the main gate to the commissary, and it was very grim. The company was on the verge of bankruptcy. I kept writers going, and I found that they had purchased several years before The Sound of Music. And I thought, why haven't they put this in work? They'd never put a writer on it or anything. So I got Ernie Lehman, who had done West Side Story and was a great, great writer. He stayed on to write the script, and I had several other scripts going. And 4 months later, we opened the gates of the studio. The hills were alive again. So, you know, we were back alive as a studio, but we came very, very close to closing the doors forever.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Butch Cassidy. That was initially supposed to have Marlon Brando in it. Am I right about that?
It was originally brought to me with Paul Newman and Steve McQueen.
Oh, Steve McQueen. Oh, okay.
Steve McQueen. And actually, we had a very, very tough time working out a billing for the two of them. And Steve thought he was a bigger star. He just made The Great Escape. Paul had certainly been nominated many times by that time and been a star longer. Felt Steve was just a newcomer out of TV. So we could never do it. I built models of a spinning wheel with their names on it, revolving. I had half the world. I had a globe with half the world cut up with one's name on one side of the world. We worked everything out. Couldn't do it. Then we started. So Steve dropped out, and we talked to Warren Beatty about it, and he wanted to do it. But he was more interested in the relationship with the girl and being the two guys and the girl. And so he, you know, we got a little scared of that. And then we talked about several other people. Redford was someone that I didn't know much of. I'd seen him in Barefoot on the Park. I thought he was too collegiate and so forth, and I was really the one holdout on Redford. And I'd known him as a young man because we competitively swam together in Santa Monica. But I hadn't really followed his career. He was, you know, good-looking, more collegiate than I thought this role called for. And George Roy Hill, the director, Paul Newman, and Bill Goldman, who had written the original screenplay, kept sending me messages, calling me, saying, you've got to use this guy, he's the perfect guy, and so forth. I finally gave in, and after the first day's daily seeing him, I didn't realize that you put him on a horse and, you know, lengthen his hair and put him in a cowboy outfit, he was the perfect guy. And I saw it after the first day's shooting, and I called everybody up, and he said, you're so right. How could I have missed this one? But they were a great team. I love that picture.
So in the middle of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, there's a Burt Bacharach song, right?
Yes.
Raindrops Are Falling on My Head.
Yeah.
And it's so odd, you know, like it's just like Western and a period piece, and suddenly there's a Burt Bacharach song and basically like a music video. You know, Paul Newman's driving Catherine Ross on the handlebars of his bicycle and Bacharach's playing in the background. What did you think when you first saw that? Did you think, perfect, what a great idea, or did you think, this is ludicrous?
No, I loved the idea. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid was more of a myth than, I mean, they were real characters. But, you know, the whole idea of it and the way we ended it with them going out in a blaze of glory, the whole thing was a little bit non-Western. It was, you know, there was a bit of tongue-in-cheek in all of it. It was more fun. It wasn't a true Western in the traditional sense. So when this was conceived early on, and then we heard Burt's song, we loved the idea. And I remember when I took it back to New York to show my father and the board of directors right before a board meeting, we had lunch afterwards and after the picture, and they all loved the picture, but one board member, stodgy old fool, said, "This is a Western. What's that song doing in there? Raindrops keep falling on my head. That's stupid." And then another board member said, "Hey, Ed, you're right. I kind of thought that was silly in this picture." And they all started ganging up on me, and I had an argument and left. But the song stayed in the movie and became a classic, won the Academy Award. It's one of Burt Bacharach's great pieces. I thought it was a delightful interlude, and it just, exemplified the nature of the picture, the whole fun of it all.
Film producer Richard Zanuck will be back in the second half of the show. His latest film is Sweeney Todd. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Raindrops keep falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting sculptures by Martin Puryear. More at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, is it a website, a TV show? Our TV critic David Bianculli talks with TV producer and writer Marshall Herskovitz about his new internet series Quarter Life, which was just picked up by NBC. And we continue our conversation with film producer Richard Zanuck. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with film producer Richard Zanuck. He's the son of the producer Daryl F. Zanuck, the co-founder of the studio 20th Century Fox. Richard became the president of his father's studio at the age of 27. Now he has his own production company. His latest production is Tim Burton's adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd. Richard Zanuck has had many successes over the years, including The Sound of Music, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, Jaws, and Driving Miss Daisy. Let's talk about a movie that didn't do so well for you. And I'm thinking of Hello, Dolly, which starred Barbara Streisand in the Carol Channing role. This was made in 1969. And 1969 is a year that young people are like dropping LSD and taking over college campuses. The nation is divided over the war in Vietnam. And Hello, Dolly just seems so out of step with what was happening culturally in America. And it was a really big flop. What was it like for you making that? And did you see it coming? Did you see like a big flop coming?
Hello, Dolly was, at that time, the biggest stage musical in the history of American theater. All the road companies had played through many, many actresses all across the country, and it was just a huge hit on stage, and so we had all, and the music was very popular. Louis Armstrong singing this song, Hello Dolly, and everything. Instead of getting Carol Channing or someone like that, we took the hottest singer of the day, which was Barbara Streisand, was just, you know, had killed them in pictures. She was doing great concert tours. The records were selling well. The concept of it just didn't work. And I thought we made a pretty good movie out of it. And God knows that it was expensive. We built the whole Hello Dolly Street and the parade and all of that. But, you know, things don't always work out. Every picture isn't going to be a hit. And when they cost a lot, they're going to lose a lot. And that's exactly what happened.
Now, your father, Darryl F. Zanuck, who had hired you to be the president of 20th Century Fox, fired you in 1970. Why?
Well, he should have. I would have fired myself. I made, you know, three musicals, Hello Dolly, Dr. Doolittle, and Star. Star with the same team, Robert Wise, Julie Andrews, as had made Sound of Music. I was chasing that rainbow of the Sound of Music. And it's funny that we started the program talking about Sweeney Todd, which is a musical in the horror sense. But I had vowed never to touch another musical because I really felt that those three big musicals had cost me my job. So, no, I brought the studio to its knees. I mean, we had made, during the course of that period, Patton, MASH, The French Connection, and Planet of the Apes, and a lot of other successful pictures, but we couldn't recover from the damage that befell us with those three big musicals. So, you know, he had every right to. I would have fired anybody under those circumstances.
How did he tell you the news?
He didn't. The board of directors, of which he was, I was the president of the company, and he was chairman of the board. We had a special meeting right before Christmas in which he told the board, you know, what he wanted. There was a vote, and it was more like an execution. I was right there and put up a feeble fight, and that was it. Probably the best thing that ever happened to me in a way, because I became an independent producer, and a couple of years later, my partner and I, David Brown, had outgrossed 20th Century Fox with our own personal finances.
And you're probably referring here to the success of Jaws.
Jaws and the Sting, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What made you decide to go ahead with Jaws? And this was Steven Spielberg's second movie. His first Sugarland Express was not a big hit. Why?
I produced the first movie.
Mm-hmm. Why did you have so much confidence in him?
Well, I saw right from the beginning that this guy was a genius. He knew more about the camera, how to move the camera and move people in and out of the camera. He knew more about lenses than any cinema photographer did. He's just has that ability. He has an eye for staging and all of the rest. I love Sugarland Express. It's one of, in my opinion, it's one of his best pictures. It led to our selecting him for Jaws, which, you know, set his career on fire as a major player in the industry and didn't do much harm to my career either.
Since you grew up spending a lot of time in your father's studio, 20th Century Fox, then took over the studio and then became an independent producer and made a lot of hits, you know, as an independent producer, I'm interested in hearing what you think you borrowed and what you think you rejected from the production style of your father, Darryl F. Zanuck.
Well, it was great having a master filmmaker, since I wanted to go into film and follow into his steps. And I was watching ever since I can remember his every move. I would spend whole weekends with him in a projection room at the studio. I would come every chance I had as a young person. And as a matter of fact, he would say, come on your way to school. I'm running something for a group of executives. And he'd run a rough cut with the executives. And then he and I would step out in the hall and he'd say, what do you think? And he was actually, he wasn't doing it for me. He was doing it for him. He wanted to know what a 14 or 15-year-old opinion of what he had just seen. And so I think you have to be decisive. I think you have to have a good sense of what plays, what won't play. He would read a script and couldn't always give you a solution for something that was bothering him. But if he'd sense that from page 20 to 25 there's a lull, it's not quite working, he'd come up with probably a corny idea, saying, she throws a frying pan across the kitchen, hits him in the head. Some crazy notion like that, which wasn't a solution, but you knew you better look at page 20 to 25 because there's something wrong with it. Find something else that is more plausible and more playable.
We were talking before about how much it hurt when your father fired you after you supervised a series of flops at 20th Century Fox. But he got ousted from his position of chairman of the board, I think, about a year after you got fired. What was it like for you to watch him be ousted?
Well, at the end of the meeting in which I got fired, we walked out together rather solemnly, and I just turned to him and I said, you're next. And he gave me the big chuckle. He said, these are all my guys, kiddo, meaning the board members. William Randolph Hearst and all of Robert Lehman. And so he thought he had them all in his pocket, but he made a series of mistakes in the next few months, and he was out within 6 months later. And it was very sad. I came to see him. We hadn't spoken since that fatal board meeting in which I was axed. But I flew in, and we met and embraced and everything, and it was, kind of a Greek tragedy. We're both out, and it hurt more for him because he had founded the company from scratch, and he didn't, know what he was really going to do. He was much more lost than I had. I'd already recovered, and we needed each other for that period, and he was starting to fail a bit physically and mentally. But it was harder for me to see him get it, and it was very painful both ways. I think probably I recovered. He never really did.
One more question: do you have a favorite all-time film?
No, I don't. I do secretly, but I'm not going to expose it.
Because
they're all my children. I love them dearly.
Right.
You know this, how it goes.
I know that story. Okay. Richard Zanuck, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much. I really have enjoyed it.
Film producer Richard Zanuck, his latest movie is Tim Burton's adaptation of Sweeney Todd. Coming up, Marshall Herskovitz on his new internet series, which is moving to TV. This is Fresh Air. With his production partner, Ed Zwick, our guest Marshall Herskovitz created the TV series 30-something and Once and Again and produced My So-Called Life. With Zwick as co-producer, Herskovitz has written and directed a new drama for the internet called Quarter Life. It's about creative people in their 20s going through a quarter-life crisis and centers on a young woman named Dylan, played by Betsy Tulloch. She wants to be a writer and finds her own voice when she starts a video blog reporting on her life and inner feelings.
It's my curse that I can see what people are thinking, what they want to say and can't say, who they want to be with. And what good does that do me if nobody can see me?
Quarter Life was just picked up by NBC for broadcast in February as an hour-long series. But Herskovitz made it expressly for the internet, cutting each one-hour episode into 6 8-minute video pieces. They're available on the website MySpace. They're also available on a new website called Quarter Life, which was created by Herskovitz in conjunction with the series. Quarterlife.com is also the website on which Dylan, in the series Quarter Life, is posting her video blogs. Our TV critic David Bianculli spoke to Marshall Herskovitz.
I would imagine that here you wrote all these episodes trying to figure out what 25-year-olds were like, and then you get those scripts out, you produce those programs, and then you start hearing from actual 25-year-olds being inundated by what they're actually thinking and feeling and doing.
Yes.
How close did you get?
Well, remember, I do have access to 25-year-olds in my own life. The genesis of this project came from the fact that Ed Zwick and I realized that our entire office was filled with 25-year-olds, and we were listening to them talk every day, and they were talking to us. And you know, we've had this longstanding odd interest in various moments in people's lives, you know, whether in their 30s or in their teens or in their 40s. And all of a sudden we looked at each other and said, hey, people in their 20s are kind of interesting. Let's do a show about that. And of course, you know, we dimly remember the fact that we were once in our 20s. And in fact, you know, that was a remarkable time in both of our lives. First of all, that's when we met each other. It's when we became best friends and creative partners. That's, you know, when you're in your 20s, you end up, whether you like it or not, making decisions that affect the rest of your life, who you may or may not marry, what field you go into, whether you pursue the career you wanted to or whether you give up on it. All sorts of things happen in your 20s that are quite remarkable.
I wonder if you could compare and contrast Claire Danes in My So-Called Life with Betsy Tulloch and her character of Dylan in Quarter Life.
I guess, you know, the character that Claire played was a darker person than Dylan in this. I would say My So-Called Life is in general a darker show than this show is, and I think that was intentional on my part. You know, My So-Called Life was this very true document of what it's like to be 16 years old, and the stakes when you're 16 really do seem life and death every day. And I think that's what Winnie Holtzman so beautifully evoked in that show. My favorite episode of My So-Called Life was the one we called The Zit, where Angela Chase has a pimple. And the show ranges around philosophically all the way from race relations to Kafka's Metamorphosis. And there's nothing silly about that, because in the world of a teenager, the presentation of self, you know, puts you in the same level as racial prejudice or anything else. And in fact, you know, people responded to that very, very strongly.
Is 10 years enough distance for you to look at something like that and give yourself a grade? I remember at one point in his career, Kurt Vonnegut graded all of his novels and gave some A's and some B's and C's. Can you do that with your work at this point?
Yeah, I can. Well, first of all, you know, My So-Called Life is mostly Winnie Holtzman's work. I mean, I am so proud to have collaborated with her on that. And, you know, I wrote and directed one of the episodes, and I was there every day helping her. But this was her voice, and the pilot was Scott Winant's direction. And so it's easy for me to look at that and say, this is genius. You know, I don't say that about myself, but I can say it about them. So I'd give that an A+. In terms of my own work, I would say there are a few episodes of 30-something that I think are pretty damn good. I think there are a lot that are good and a lot that were less than good, and a very few that were really, really good and that I'm proud of.
Is there one that really leaps out that you'd like to just remind everybody about right now?
Well, I think the episode for me that sort of went into another sphere altogether was the one called Therapy. And it had an intimacy in it, talking about the issues that a married couple sort of face that was really kind of startling. And when you look at it again, it's still startling in a way. And again, it was so honest. The octane of truth was so high in that that it just kind of knocks you out and still holds up today. So I would say that for me was sort of the one that kind of gets me from that whole series.
I love that phrase, the octane of truth.
Well, we used to joke about that, Ed and I, when we were doing the show. We realized that in general, in 30-something, if the octane was too high, it would start to freak people out and they didn't like it. And if it was too low, then they didn't believe it. And we used to say, we need to be around 92 octane of truth for this show to be at its optimum performance.
More of my so-called life questions. The audience that that program had wasn't valued then, but it's all that's valued now.
Yes.
Am I right about thinking that?
Yes, I would say that. That's the one time in my career when it can be documented that I was ahead of my time because the networks had no interest whatsoever in teenagers at that time. Teenage girls in particular were completely invisible to them. In fact, you'll laugh at this, but when we were trying to keep the show on the air, we called Bob Iger, and who was head of the network at that time, and we said to him, you know, you're not losing money on this show. We know you're getting a premium from advertisers. So this is not a question of money. We know you have low ratings, but you should keep the show on the air because it's corporate good works. You are literally giving a voice to a group of people in the culture who have had no voice up until now. That's literally what we said to him. And it started to change right after that show was canceled. In fact, I would actually chart the change to the Romeo and Juliet film with Claire Danes and Leo DiCaprio that was a huge hit, like just 6 months after the show was canceled, that started this sort of youth and in particular teenage girl sort of thing in the culture where all of a sudden advertisers and marketers and film studios wanted that demographic. We were just a bit too early for it.
We're listening to the interview our TV critic David Bianculli recorded with Marshall Herskovitz. His new internet and TV series is called Quarter Life. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview our TV critic David Bianculli recorded with TV producer, writer, and director Marshall Herskovitz, whose programs include 30-something, My So-Called Life, and the new internet and TV series Quarter Life.
You're president of the Producers Guild of America, which
yes.
is different from the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers against whom the writers are striking. So you're not the target of a strike.
Thank you for saying that. That's correct.
But what's the difference between these two? How are you different?
If you go to the AMPTP, the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, you won't find any producers. Those are big companies and executives. You know, they are represented by the six major media companies that dominate all media in the United States. Producers are people like me who try to get projects done. They are generally independent. Sometimes they have deals at studios, but they live by their wits. They live on their own. They try to get funding for the projects they love. They are much more aligned with the writers and the directors in this town than they are with the big companies that run the show. So it's actually been very important for us. We've been writing letters to Variety and Hollywood Reporter and the Los Angeles Times, trying to get them to stop referring to the AMPTP as producers, because they're not.
Well, you did an essay in the LA Times, just printed just a couple of days after the strike began, about what's happening to television, not just about the issues of the strike, but about the issues of corporate ownership. And you basically said that government policy and corporate strategy are poisoning the TV business. I mean, what's happened since you started that is so different?
Well, the biggest thing that happened was the decision by the FCC in 1995 to abolish its financial syndication rules, which, to make a very long story short, allowed networks to own the programs that they broadcast. Until then, networks were precluded from owning the programs that they broadcast because it was felt that it would give networks too much power if they did. And boy, that was a wise decision back in the 70s when they passed that. And when this was abolished in 1995, which, by the way, was around the same time that these very large media companies started realizing that they should be acquiring networks so that they could be these, you know, sort of consolidated entities, that all of a sudden you had Disney that owned ABC and also had its own production wing. You had the same thing with NBC, the same thing with CBS, the same thing with Fox, that all of these networks owned the programs that they broadcast, which meant that all of the independent production companies, of which there had been like 40, say, in 1990, were driven out of business because these companies only wanted to do business with themselves. And what you have now is a network, since it owns the programs, has a lot of proprietary interest in how those programs are going to be developed. And they take much more creative control over the product than they ever did before at any time in television history. They, you know, they tell the producers what clothes the people should wear. They have to decide who the director of photography is. They tell them to change the color of the walls. They give notes on every page of the script. They, you know, they're the owners. So they want to have complete creative control. The problem, as I said in the piece, is that the people exerting this creative control are executives. They're not artists. They're not writers. They're not production designers. So they're not necessarily equipped to be making those decisions. And what you have then is decisions by committee and decisions by research. So it's very difficult to be creative under those circumstances.
Now, you're maintaining control of Quarter Life, not only editorial control in what you're doing, but you're maintaining ownership.
Yes, that's correct.
And yet, NBC has bought it, or bought the second rights to it, to be able to show it in, I guess, February on TV.
Yes.
And NBC is going to benefit from the strike, I guess, because, hey, look, it's original programming that you were actually making to get away from the networks, and yet here it is. I mean, I don't know. I don't know where the chicken and where the egg is here, because you made network quality program for the internet, probably the first one that really can be called a network level show as we know it for the internet, and then the network takes it back. So it's sort of like just another development arm. How do you see it?
Well, I see it somewhat differently from that, and I think it's important to elucidate, because, especially because of the strike. I think, first of all, it's important to know that we made a deal with NBC 2 months before the strike that was quite an extensive deal. They invested in our website. They became our distribution partner for worldwide rights for the show, and they had an option, a right of first refusal, it's called, for a network play. So they had not decided whether they were going to put it on television, but they had the right to do it. And that was concluded 2 months before the strike. So there was no legal basis whereby we could withhold this from them, once they picked up the option, even though we were in the middle of the strike. We had already finished writing all the episodes, and in fact, we were in the last week of production. So, this wasn't done to give NBC fodder, to resist the strike. This existed before. The other thing it's important to understand is that we still own the show and we still creatively control the show. We are delivering to NBC finished episodes. They have not even seen the scripts. They don't even know what the stories are about. That's literally never happened in the history of television. So And by the way, I said in the op-ed piece that I have nothing against television. I love television. I love working in television. What I hate is the level of control that the networks have exerted and the fact that you can't be entrepreneurial anymore. But we've been able to figure out a way to do both of those things, to own this damn thing and control it ourselves. So, of course, I'm happy to go to television under those circumstances.
In the previous TV work that you've done, you've dealt with teens. Now you're dealing with 20-somethings on the web. You've dealt with 30-something once and again, sort of got into the 40s. Are you running out of decades, or do you have definite plans to do a 50-something, an 80-something, something?
Well, Ed Zwick says the only thing left is incontinent something. you know, one thing I can say is that the baby boom generation has never been shy about thinking that whatever it does is very interesting. So I'm sure when we're in our 60s, we'll think that that's the most amazing decade of life and we'll do something about then. I'm not sure anyone will want to watch, but we'll be working on it.
Marshall Herskovitz, as a multimedia pioneer, I just want to thank you for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
Marshall Herskovitz spoke with our TV critic, David Bianculli. Herskovitz's new series, Quarter Life, can be seen on the website, quarterlife.com, and will be shown on NBC in February. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Spectra, publisher of Dream Songs, Volumes 1 and 2, a collection of stories, novellas, teleplays, and more from George R.R. Martin. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the Irish rock film Once on DVD Tuesday. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, hoping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make. But let me
on the next Fresh Air, an interview with Ike Turner. He died this week at the age of 76. Also, the new movie Charlie Wilson's War is based on the book by the late journalist George Kreil. We'll listen back to an interview with Kreil and former Congressman Charlie Wilson. Join us for the next Fresh Air.